Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, my friend. Welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. I'm Louise McSharry, and this is the podcast where we aim to keep you caught up on what's going on in the world around you. If you haven't been paying attention, no problem. I have got you. Today's episode is the news catch up, and myself and Carl, there's really good stories this week. So this is actually kind of a beefy episode, but that's just because there was really a lot to talk about. A lot of interesting things happening in the news this week. And I am slightly later getting it to you than I normally would be, but that's because, well, you'll hear why, the way that my morning went when I talked to Carl. Just a note on the Laughter Lounge show. Thank you so much to everyone who bought tickets. It is sold out now, and it has been so lovely to hear from you, who, you know, everybody who's excited about going. I know that there are people who missed out on tickets, who took their time getting their tickets and are now don't have them. I've been hearing from you guys as well. We are working on another date, so hopefully there'll be another one coming soon. And aside from that, yeah, really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great. Also, in terms of the Patreon, I've had an issue with the podcast phone. It has disappeared. I'm dedicating a significant portion of time this week to trying to find it. I'm actually starting to think like Ted has taken it and like put it somewhere. I don't know if you've ever had that happen where your child just takes a shine to something and then all of a sudden it's gone. It has happened here more than once. Once with my dad's car keys while he was here. That was fun. But anyway, what I'm going to do this week, hopefully I'll be able to do the mailbag episode, but I'm also going to do an episode on the Taylor Swift album. Now, if you listen to the Beyonce Cowboy Carter, I keep calling it Coach Carter. Oh my God, Louise, get a grip. If you listen to the Beyonce Cowboy Carter episode, it'll be slightly different to that because I don't think this is the same kind of album, but there is so much gossip and like little bits of saucy info in these songs and kind of frankly hilarious lyrics and, you know, good stuff. There's just a lot to talk about. So I'm going to do an episode on that as well this week. So yeah, lots coming over on the Patreon. If you want to join us, patreon.com/catchupwithlouisemcsharry. And other than that, I don't have a whole lot to say. I went to see Emer and Sophie White. Emer McGlysett, who you know from the podcast, and Sophie's been on the podcast a few times as well. And they are both in a choir called The Lineup, and they had a big concert last night in the convention center, which I went to. And it was so lovely and wholesome and just lovely to see my pals up there singing away. And, you know, just reminding me of songs like No More I Love Yous, which I just frankly don't listen to enough. Other than that, over the weekend, I was celebrating James Kavanagh moving away from Dublin. If you watched his TV program, which I very much enjoyed, you'll know that he's bought a house and he is moving away. So we had a party for that. So busy weekend all round. Also, Ted had a vomiting bug on Friday, which was just a treat. You know, it's always a treat when you get a surprise vomiting bug in the house. So we were glued to each other for a good 24 hours, but fortunately he's much better now. So anyway, that's all my news. We might as well get into the actual news now with Carl Kinsella. Hello, Carl Kinsella, coming to you from a chaotic home in Dublin currently. As I mentioned, I was just telling Carl that this morning, so myself and Carl record first thing on a Monday morning so that we can try and get you the news update as quickly as possible. So we normally record at 9 o'clock, but it is now 9:15 because I had to send Carl a frantic message because something that has never, ever happened in my house before, well, not since I became a parent, happened. And I say this almost as like, you know, a beacon of hope for you people who are still in the depths of maybe 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., 5 a.m. starts as I was for several years. This morning, Sam got up. He's seven. Got up and came downstairs. Got himself dressed, by the way. Came downstairs on his own without waking us up, which usually, even though he would come downstairs on his own, he would come in to tell us that he's doing that. Didn't do that this morning for whatever reason. And then Ted slept till 8:15. So we only woke up when he came into our room, and Sam's school starts at 8:30. So it's been frantic. But anyway, we're here now. Carl, you were very patient and flexible with me, so I appreciate that.
No worries at all. My theory is that Sam didn't want to go to school. That's if that was me and I hadn't woken up, that's what I would have done for sure at the age of seven.
Well, when I came downstairs, I said to him, I was like, Sam, we're going to have to hurry. Like, we're late. And he was like, I know, it's 8:17. And I was like, why didn't you wake us up? So we're all going to have a conversation. I think alarms are going to have to start being set, which is like massive. Literally for 7 years, we have not had to, 7.5 years, we've not had to set alarms because the babies / kids would always wake us up. But now I think that's the phase of life we're in, which is pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. It'd be nice if they could do this on a weekend. I mean, that
yeah,
that would be nice. But you know, Sam is actually very excited about school today because so it's very funny when you have a kid because they give you, especially my kid, they give you very little information about what's going on in their lives. But then every once in a while, they're excited about something. And so they tell you stuff, but it's just bits. So like for the past week, he's been very excited about some Cambodian people coming to his school. But like no context, no like who these people are, why they're coming. He told me this morning they're teachers. So I don't know, maybe it's like some sort of exchange thing. But he's been learning about Cambodian culture and like bowing to them when they arrive. And he's very excited about that. So he was actually pretty fired up to go to school today because they've been preparing. Yeah, his school is amazing. It's an Educate Together school. They're just brilliant. Like I love his school so much. Yeah, it's great. Anyway, that's enough. That's enough babbling because we do have a lot of news to talk about. And I think we should start in Gaza, where things are no better.
No, there's been, even in the last 24 hours, there have been several horrific stories to emerge from Gaza. I think one of the most disturbing is reported by Al Jazeera that Palestinian civil defense crews uncovered a mass grave with 180 bodies found in Khan Yunis. I think what is especially shocking about that is that, you know, people have been watching Khan Yunis be bombed for months. But if you actually remember, at the outset of the bombing campaign, people were told to go to Khan Yunis. Khan Yunis was kind of labeled by the Israel government as the safe place. You know, they were intending to bomb northern Gaza and they said, travel south to Khan Yunis. And people traveled south to Khan Yunis and the bombing followed them. And now we're seeing, you know, as you know, we know that many of the Israel soldiers have pulled out, you know, so there's kind of Palestinians are returning to their villages and their towns and their cities, which are, you know, essentially just rubble. And we're discovering these awful, you know, evidence of these kind of awful atrocities. We've had, you know, specific situations of a Palestinian baby girl was delivered prematurely after an Israeli attack killed her mother. This is also in the last 24 hours, Palestinians.
I feel like we need to just pause on that because the trouble with this is that we can't help but become kind of desensitized if the horror after horror is presented to us. But, you know, that a Palestinian baby girl, Sabrine Judah, was delivered prematurely after an Israeli attack killed her mother. Like, even if we just examine, like, somehow medical professionals in the most difficult circumstances managed to deliver that baby from her dead mother, like, that in itself is an incredible thing and kind of a beam of light in the context of this. But, like, I mean, that's horrific. That poor baby girl, like, you wouldn't even know how many family members she has surviving to take care of her. And that's just one story of so many.
It's a generation of Palestinian children that have been orphaned and, you know, children that will grow up without mothers. And of course, you know, so many children have been killed, you know, over 30,000 people have been killed, but a huge percentage of those are women and children. And that's not to in any way dismiss the fact that, you know, Gazan men, their lives are just as valuable. You know, none of these civilians deserve to be dying. It is truly such a horrifying thing to think. And I saw in reference to what you say about a ray of light, I saw kind of an interesting perspective on Twitter this week. There's a man whose whole family had been killed, and he, you know, all his kind of people were around him. They were laying their hands on his chest, and it was so affecting. But a comment I saw on it was that, you know, even as there's these little victories, like as you say, you know, this baby successfully delivered. Another kind of good news story was that in northern Gaza, bakeries are starting to reopen because, you know, food is actually beginning to get in. More aid is getting in this week.
Yeah.
So as this person was saying, you celebrate the small victories, but there is still so much suffering and so much pain.
Yeah.
And it really is. It's this week was, you know, there was a few kind of big developments on the macro level in terms of, or I suppose anti-developments, you'd almost call them, because they're news stories, but nothing has been kind of progressed. So there's a vote at the UN Security Council about recognizing the state of Palestine. 12 of the 15 UN Security Council members voted in favor of it. The US, of course, vetoed it. And, you know, the US is a country with a veto on the Security Council, which means that, you know, the motion doesn't pass. Two countries abstained, that was Switzerland and the UK. So, you know, once again, it's the US and the UK who are really just at the forefront of backing this entire campaign, even as, you know, as we've noted before, even as Joe Biden sort of calls for restraint, there is no concrete steps being taken by the US. One thing I saw this week that the US is intending to sanction one of the branches of the IDF for human rights atrocities. And again, sort of goes back to what we were just saying about it's a tiny victory. And these victories are happening in such tiny incremental steps. But overall, the picture is still just horrendously bleak. And that's kind of the story of the week. There's also, you probably saw, you know, Columbia University in New York.
Yeah.
There were hundreds, possibly even thousands, I mean, huge crowds of protesters, student protesters. And they set up an encampment on the campus. Like they had tents. It was sort of a bit like kind of the Occupy Wall Street back in the day, you know, sort of like a communal thing where they all gathered together. And Columbia, I think it was last week, I don't know if it was Monday or Tuesday, they approved the NYPD to come in and basically mass arrest these people. And they were loaded onto buses and just taken off to be processed and, you know, arrested and all that.
And I read that again, some of them also lost, like they had their student IDs kind of cancelled, which means that they weren't able to access food on campus and stuff. Some people had, there was talk of scholarships being suspended and, you know, people actually being fully like suspended from the university. It's wild to me.
Because I mean, like, it's, you know, once you start kind of silencing academic freedom, you know, that's, you know, if you read sort of books about how fascism sort of happens, that's always one of the telltale signs, is that, you know, they go after students and they go after academic people. And, you know, it is just so disturbing to think that in the United States that this could be happening. And I think, you know, again, talk about a little rays of light. You know, after these students were arrested, there was a huge solidarity protest in Harvard and, you know, at other universities as well. So there is solidarity. And I do think, you know, I feel so naive saying that, you know, opinion is constantly turning more towards Palestine. It feels so naive to say that because it's happening too slowly.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is happening just in tiny increments.
Yeah. Okay, well, we will talk about it, I'm sure, next week. Let's move on to one of the other big stories of the week, which was the tale of a protest, kind of use that term loosely, outside Roderick O'Gorman's home. Lots of discussion of this week.
Yeah, so this was, I think, probably a lot of people have seen the images online, kind of very concerning. You know, Roderick O'Gorman, he's the Minister for Integration, he's a Green Party minister. And yeah, a group of, you know, we can call them far right, we can call them whatever we like. You know, they stationed themselves outside his house. There were signs draped over his gates. A lot of them were masked, some of them in balaclavas, some of them were stopping cars on the road outside his house. What I can't understand about it is that there were two Garda cars parked there for the entire time. Obviously, the policy at this point, we can see clearly, is to not engage. Don't know how wise that is. Doesn't seem to have stymied the sort of the momentum of the far right at all. Not sure, you know, what the
thinking
logic
is
there,
but,
you know, virtually every TD in Ireland has come out and condemned and, you know, you're talking about even people who would be on so ideologically opposed to what the government is doing, people like Paul Murphy, people before Profit, they are all so emphatic that this is wrong.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it is it's the line between, you know, protest and intimidation, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I mean, we've seen this before. This is not the first time. Simon Harris, I think when he He had a protest at his house. Paul Murphy had a protest at his house when he had a very new baby. Like, we're kind of lucky in Ireland that we have relatively easy access to our politicians. Like, they don't live largely in gated communities or with Secret Service guards outside of their homes. But we will have to move toward that if this continues. And I mean, even the developments that we've seen in the city centre a couple of weeks ago on the day, or last week, was it? I have no concept of time, Carl, ever. Like, I mean, truly, it could be a week or a year ago. But when, on the day that Simon Harris has made Taoiseach, I had an appointment. I have therapy every week, and my appointment is near the Dáil. And I had an absolute nightmare trying to get to my appointment because they had blocked off all of the Dáil side of Merrion Square and all of Kildare Street. So, you know, it was very inconvenient for me. But what was the most upsetting part of it for me was that they had to do it at all. And that's where we are now, that, like, you know, we have to be so worried about these people's safety. And also, why would good people, good, reasonable people get into politics if they think that this is the stuff they're going to have to put up with? So you're going to, you know, the impact of it is multifaceted. And I just think, for me, it's the masks. I'm kind of like, if you want to, I could see an argument. I personally don't think the protest should be taken to people's homes. I just don't. But I could kind of see the argument. I could kind of get into that frame of mind were it not for the masks. Like, if you're protesting something that you really believe in, that you have no shame in protesting about, you are principled and you believe in your politics, why do you need to cover up your face?
Yeah, I think it's an intention to create fear and to create sort of uncertainty. And I think what's really notable as well is that Roderick O'Gorman, who he has been a target for these kind of groups since long before the Ukraine war and the influx of refugees. Mm. So Roderick O'Gorman was targeted, I think, as early as 2020 or 2021 as, you know, and, you know, you can't necessarily ascribe motive to people, but, like, you know, Roderick O'Gorman is a gay man. He is minister for, you know, a lot of kind of contentious departments. We talk about, he's minister for integration, he's minister for children. These are things that the far right tend to focus on and zero in on.
Yeah.
And Roderick O'Gorman, he has been, like, even in I think it was late 2020, or could have been 2021. But even then, there were protests by people outside the Dáil with, you know, with reference to Roderick O'Gorman, they had a banner with a noose on it. So, you know, for me, I think that it's like the integration policies and the immigration policies. It's just for me, it seems like it's just a pretext almost to, you know, abuse this man. You know, Roderick O'Gorman, he is the Minister for Integration, but he is not the sole decider of government immigrant policy.
No,
you know, that's a collective decision. He's a Green Party minister, so they are the junior members in the coalition. As you say, it really is going to put people off going into politics. But I think even more so, who on earth is going to, after the next election, who the hell will want to be the integration minister?
Oh.
You know, like, who the hell is going to take that job?
No
one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, no reasonable person would say yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, I'll bring that on myself. But I mean, I guess maybe politicians aren't reasonable. No, I don't mean that. Yeah. But it's such a life to step into. And it's, you know, when we were kids, that wasn't a thing you had to consider. Like, it just wasn't. You know, things have changed so much even in just the last kind of 5 years, I feel like.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And as people were pointing out as well, like, you know, Roderick O'Gorman, he's a politician, you know, as by his own volition. Mm. But, you know, his partner, his kids, his family, his neighbor, right? And those people all end up being intimidated.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a very disturbing trend.
Mm.
And you know, Simon Harris was, I think, he was quite strong on it. Mm. He said he was going to meet with Commissioner Drew Harris about it. And of course, as you mentioned, he has been targeted for this kind of stuff before, so I imagine it's quite personal for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's indicative of we're going to get some kind of stronger, tougher measures against these sort of, you know, kind of quote unquote protests.
There has to be. Like, I just really think that the number of people in this country, regular citizens, I mean, who would think that that's OK, are in the small minority. I think that any reasonable person knows that that's not OK, that it's crossing a line. You know, these people have a right to have personal lives outside of their professional lives. And, like, you know, to inflict this kind of stuff on someone's family, in their home, on their neighbors, is completely unacceptable. So I would think he would have public support on that if he did decide to go harder on it. So hopefully we do see a bit of a turnabout there. Okay, now let's talk about Stardust. The the court case about Stardust has been going on for quite some time now, but obviously the families of the victims of the Stardust disaster have been suffering for years and years and years without answers as to what where the blame really lay in terms of what happened to their loved ones. And there was a verdict, and there has been fallout, obviously. So tell us about that.
Yes. So on Thursday, one of really just a hugely momentous day, you know, the families of the 48 people who passed away in the 1981 fire, they gathered in the Rotunda room. And it's like, my colleague Christine Bowen was there. She was reporting live. Mm-hmm. It sounded truly like one of the most sort of tense, emotionally loaded days, really, in kind of recent Irish history. Mm-hmm. The verdict that was returned by the jury, there's a few kind of different verdicts available to them. And I think a thing that's kind of important to make clear just before I get into that is that an inquest is not about determining guilt or innocence. Mm. It's just about establishing the kind of the facts around, you know, how somebody has died, the facts around an incident.
Sure.
So the verdict that was returned was a verdict of unlawful killing. Mm. I think that is what the families were hoping for. Mm. That was kind of the toughest a verdict that the jury could return, unlawful killing. And I think what was maybe even more important for the families was the jury had to return answers as to, you know, so loads of, you know, we know this for months, there were testimonies given to the jury. So it was up to them to sort of parse all that information and come to a conclusion about what happened in Stardust in 1981. And it's what the conclusion they've come to is that it was an electrical fault that started in the hot press. That's how the fire began. Mm. It spread then dangerously due to carpet tiles on the bathroom. This is how it spread. And reports from Stardust, you know, from the people who survived, the speed at which it, you know, that always strikes me as like the speed at which it went up in flames, I think was always very confusing to people and very disturbing. And I think the carpet tiles go some way to sort of answering that mystery. Mm. And then I think most crucially is that the jury was asked, did the locked doors impede the escape of the people who were in the club? Mm. And the jury said yes. Mm. And they were asked, did that contribute to the deaths? And they said yes. Mm. And I think that's what the Stardust families have been waiting to hear all these years. Yeah. They wanted to hear that there were choices made by certain people that ultimately, you know, resulted in an unlawful killing of, you know, 48 people. Mm. The fallout, as you say, has been, it's been kind of mixed in the sense of, you know, they want an apology. Simon Harris has apologized, on behalf of the state. And I suppose I think a huge part of that is not just necessarily apologizing for the incident itself, but also the fact that it's taken 43 years.
Yeah.
43 years for there to be, people have passed away waiting for, you know, to learn kind of what happened to their loved one.
It's insane. It's like 43 years. It's a lifetime. You know,
and something I always think, Louise, is that whenever I see any comments by people, and this kind of applies, I think, mostly to the far right, and they talk about Ireland returning to some glory days, this is what I think of when I think of Ireland gone by, is poor regulation, you know, whitewash reports, you know, awful situations that don't get dealt with. Mm. And I think, why would we ever want to return to that?
Certainly not.
Eamon Butterley, who was the manager of the Stardust, at the time, he's, you know, a man who's, you know, hugely vilified and despised by the families. He's kind of gone to ground. He's made no public comment since the verdict of the unlawful killing. I know the Independent tried to contact him at an address they had for him. A woman answered the door and told them to fuck off. Mm-hmm. They asked, was he there? And she told them to fuck off and go find them themselves. So I don't know if he's an older man now, Eamon Butterley. I don't know if we'll ever really get a public comment from him.
Yeah.
I think that's probably something that the Stardust families that would offer even more closure. Yeah. I think that's still something they desperately want. And I think as well, you know, the state apologies, you know, as Simon Harris is offering for this, you know, we've had similar state apologies in the past with respect to the Magdalen laundries and other such sort of national scandals. Mm. And I think, you know, it's the kind of thing where people appreciate the apology and it's something that has to be done, but it also needs to be matched with concrete steps. And, you know, obviously regulation in Ireland has come on leaps and bounds since 1981. We, you know, it's it's if you were into to be in a club now and you were to see a padlocked door, I think there would be huge consequences for for the owners.
But I mean, also, I think that we're all just more educated, and you know, if you were out in a nightclub, I mean, first of all, you'd have to find a nightclub. But if you were out in a nightclub and there was a padlocked door, you yourself, alarm bells would ring.
Absolutely.
You know, because we know, because we've learned from this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a different time.
Yeah. And so it's something that I think this will remain in the national consciousness forever. I don't think that just because we have this verdict that I don't think you can really say necessarily that justice has been done.
Yeah.
But I think what has been given to the families is a sense of closure and a sense of, you know, just they can now point to something and say this officially is what happened. Mm-hmm. I think that has been very beneficial for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, it is just heartbreaking. I mean, when you think about, it never fails to hit me hard when I think about those young people getting dressed up and going for their night out and not going home. It is horrendous. And, you know, for families, like, I know one of the families had three children who died in, you know, and the community was impacted so heavily. It can't be underestimated, kind of the seismic nature of what happened that night. And I'm really glad if the families have managed to get some peace from this, albeit much too late.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, now I want to talk about the cast review. This is tricky stuff, and it has been kind of taken and misinterpreted, I think, in many different ways since it came out, which is why we're talking about it this week rather than last week when it had just freshly come out. So first of all, what is the cast review?
Yeah, so the cast review is a review that was undertaken sort of in terms of the NHS's approach towards gender healthcare for young people in the UK. This actually has huge consequences for transgender children in Ireland as well, because access to transgender healthcare in Ireland is so limited that a lot of people do travel to the UK for it. And what the CAST review has recommended is that basically the key finding of the CAST report was that they said that there is not enough good evidence for the use of puberty blockers in, you know, children. Mm. It's an extremely complicated, complicated is maybe the wrong word, because the thing is, trans people are people, you know, they are humans with human rights, and they, you know, as I think a lot of people, particularly anyone who's ever had kind of a health concern, will know, patients need to be at the center of, you know, kind of the considerations.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, what we want to do first and foremost, obviously, is prioritize the well-being of young trans people.
100%.
Yeah. The report did find that, like, it's that the main kind of argument is that there was not enough good evidence in support of puberty blockers. I think it's, you know,
I'm sorry, let's just pause for a second, because for anybody who doesn't know, puberty blockers are medications which delay the kind of physical changes that come with puberty. And they were originally used for children who started puberty much too early. And that was their original use. And it was, you know, if children started experiencing puberty at like 8 or 9, and they would use these to kind of wait until it was more age appropriate. And then it started being used in the cases of children who were experiencing gender dysphoria, who didn't feel like their bodies matched the gender that they felt themselves to be. And the idea was it would give the kids time to, you know, grow up a little bit more and then decide, you know, whether that was still how they felt or, you know, whether they changed. It kind of, the idea is pressing pause so that, you know, your voice doesn't start changing, you don't start growing facial hair, these kinds of things. So you can understand the argument for them. However, what the review found was that the evidence is actually a little bit shaky, and there is like issues, I think, with bone density can be arisen from these medications, and that it's actually, I think what I got, and you can obviously, you have been looking at it more closely than me, was that it's just not doing enough good to warrant their usage, right?
Yeah, that's the argument. And it's sort of, they said that it doesn't actually really allow the breathing space. I think they said that there weren't very strong sort of mental health outcomes in terms of feeling better. They also kind of, they cited the risk of detransitioning. And I think a huge complaint about the report was that they actually didn't have that many examples of people who sought to detransition.
Yeah.
I think that was a huge criticisms of the report. Like that's, you know, without question. It's a contentious report. And, you know, I have to say, hand in our, on heart, like I'm not an expert in trans healthcare.
No.
You know, I am not the person who can distinguish from, you know, I cannot tell you, I haven't read these data sets. I think another major criticism was that, so they used, they wanted high quality and medium quality studies, and they had 103, and they said 60 of the 103 were either high or medium quality, and the other 43 were just too low quality. And what they said was, even in the high and medium quality reports, that like, that there were findings that maybe wouldn't necessarily be acceptable in other areas of medicine. This has been disputed. All of this is in dispute. There is a group, let me just get their name. So it's the World Professional Association of Trans Health. They're a big group. They were kind of lambasted in the report, but they kind of have defended themselves. And a guy, Dr. Sam Wong, he's sort of part of that. He's president of the Alberta Medical Association in Canada. He has said that within a few months, it's obviously the person. So this is an issue, right? Is that when you're doing a study like this, the reason that it kind of might not be perfect is because you can't do a blind test. Oftentimes when you're testing medication, the outcomes of medication, you have a group that knows they're on the medication, and then you have the doctors and the patients maybe on a placebo, or they, you know, don't know. So there's no option for a placebo here, because as this doctor says, you either know you're on puberty blockers or you're not. So that's why this is quite hard to study. But the point this guy, Dr. Sam Wong, was making is that he was arguing that the findings of the CAST report and the recommendations of the CAST report to suspend the use of puberty blockers is akin to saying that, oh, we don't understand pregnancy, so we can't provide healthcare for pregnant women, you know? So it's like, it's all about a lack of understanding. It's like, we don't really know. It's what is at the kernel of this is that there's an uncertainty about the effectiveness of this treatment. You know, it's been cast into doubt. But at the same time, this is something that so many trans people and trans children feel like they need.
Yeah.
And that is a huge tension and a friction. And it's something that, you know, it's going to have huge consequences. And it's sort of, you know, as I say, it's very hard to come down, because as you say, if there is evidence that puberty blockers can do damage, I don't know sort of where that leaves us, because they are, I think in some cases, so many trans people will tell you that they're necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I saw someone on TikTok, a trans woman on TikTok not long ago, and she was answering questions, and someone had said, you know, what did you do to make your voice so feminine? And she said, I was just really lucky, and I was able to access puberty blockers as a teenager. And she was like, my life is so much easier because of it. So it's not black and white, you know, this kind of thing. You're talking about mental health as well as physical health. And, you know, it is complicated. And I think what's really The trouble, well, there's many troubles, but one of the big problems around this kind of stuff is that there's no room for rational conversation, or there seems to be no room for rational conversation, and everything is kind of pushed into this black or white, which camp are you in kind of thing. So like I've had, because I write about trans rights and I've spoken about trans rights and I will always, absolutely always advocate for the rights of trans people. I have a lot of people who, you know, kind of harass me a little bit online. It doesn't, like, look, it's nothing compared to what other people get. But I have now, for days, people have been commenting on stuff that I post. Read the cast report. Have you read the cast report? And it's like, the cast report is not saying that trans people don't exist or they don't have a right to treatment. In fact, that's the opposite of what it's saying. It's saying trans people, trans children require assistance and they require simple, direct access to assistance. It's just a question of, is this the right assistance for them to get? And, you know, what's happened, the fallout from it is that everyone is kind of taking little bits of information to support whatever their position is. And it's very hard to get to the nitty gritty of what's actually true.
Yeah, and that's, I feel like that kind of brings you back to why it's so key that individual patients are always at the center of their own care.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like, for me, it's almost like the idea of banning a medication. And to be fair, it's banned. It's not going to be banned in medical trials, but it will just be banned kind of in terms of prescriptions. Mm. But, you know, that's so prescriptive. You know, you can't decide that this doesn't work. You know, it's not like, you can't decide that a medication either works for everyone or doesn't work for anyone. Yeah. You know, that's so, and I think what's concerning for a lot of people, a lot of trans people, is that so the CAST report is named for Dr. Hilary CAST. She's the woman who was sort of in charge of the entire, and there's, I mean, hundreds of people worked on it, but she oversaw it. And she said that, I think a crucial thing that people have picked up on is that she kind of was on Twitter. She followed a lot of, you know, TERF type people, you know. I think that sort of that already, you know, made people very jittery about it. And I think in the aftermath, as you say, as you've seen in your comments, the kind of the very aggressive anti-trans base, who are, you know, really some of the most awful people on the internet, they are behaving as though they're vindicated by this.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so kind of frightening for probably like young trans people must be in a kind of a real state of fear.
Yeah. And parents of young trans people, because at the end of the day, like the vast majority of parents, fortunately, from what I've seen, you know, just love their child and want to support their child and get them whatever, you know, help it is that they need that's going to help them be at peace. Because trans people are, you know, the impact of not being treated appropriately as a young trans person is immense. Like, I mean, trans people are more at risk for suicide. They're more at risk for other mental health crises. Like, you just want your kid to be happy. And, you know, the idea that they are at the center of some debate, which I will never get my head around why anti-trans people are so obsessed with this issue. Like, I can't understand it on any level. It's so bizarre to me. I usually can get myself into the frame of mind to try and understand other people. This one, I just can't. But for those parents and those children themselves, like, this is, it's such a difficult environment just even to exist in.
Yeah. And like this, you know, this is about, it's about healthcare and it's about children. It's not about a culture war. You know, it's not about trying to make people look like, you know, assholes online. It's not about calling, you know, talk about Graham Linehan, like not about calling people names, not about, you know, trying to start fights and be violent. It's about making sure that kids have the access to the healthcare that they need on an individual level, whatever is right for that child is needs to be done.
And if puberty blockers aren't good enough, then let's find something better. That's not to say, and I don't, you know, look, I'm not an expert either, but that, you know, the idea of a doctor saying, you know, these actually aren't working well enough and I don't think they're appropriate for trans or anti-trans people, to take that as a victory and be like, yeah, fuck you, trans people. Like, you don't, she doesn't think you should exist. It's like, no, that's not what she said. And it's wild. But, and she's, I mean, she has been at the receiving end of an insane amount of abuse from both the kind of extreme people on both sides, because there are people calling her a TERF and then there are people kind of claiming her as their own. And, you know, I read she's not going on public transport at the moment because it's too risky for her. And that the, you know, she said her team, she was asked about kind of the online abuse. She said, there are some pretty vile emails coming in at the moment, most of which my team is protecting me from, so I'm not getting to see them. She said, what dismays me is just how childish the debate can become. If I don't agree with somebody, then I'm called transphobic or a TERF. You know, and but then there are people who, you know, would never call someone a TERF. There are TERFs themselves who are, you know, also kind of having an issue with her because it's not extreme enough. Like, you just can't win.
Yeah, I think just one of the most disturbing things that I picked up from it in the aftermath was there as a Labour MP, Wes Streeting, who years ago he had made a statement. He said, trans men are men, trans women are women. He was full on for trans rights and he was emphatic about it. In the wake of the Cass report, he disavowed that statement. And I think that is, you know, that gets to the kernel of why this is so toxic. Yeah. Because that is not what the report said. The report, you know, well, I think the issue is that the report sort of, because it doesn't necessarily take into account the feelings of individual patients, because it's looking at data sets in like a broad sense, is that it doesn't really communicate the report. It doesn't communicate that, you know, this is a human issue. You know, it's really hard. And like, you know, as you say, you've written about trans rights, like, All I feel as I sit here is that I want every trans person to feel safe. I want every trans person to feel safe in their body. I want them to get the access to the care they need. Mm. You know, the fact that Ireland doesn't have sufficient trans healthcare is a disgrace. And it's just such a tough, it's a tough thing to talk about and it's a tough thing to think about. And, you know, there's because of the controversy, the UK government has already announced they're going to launch a second report, and Hillary is not going to be part of that. So when we end up getting something that is maybe a little more patient focused, maybe a little more human, a little more empathetic, I think that's people just feel like the empathy, I think, is stripped out of these conversations.
Because that's the thing, you're talking about individual people. You know, and I agree, like, I want every person to be able to, it shouldn't be radical to say that you want every individual person on the planet to be able to live truthfully as themselves, without that being dangerous for them. Like, that shouldn't be a radical thing. If you're not hurting anyone else, like, where is the issue? I just don't understand it. The Journal has an absolutely brilliant explainer episode, by the way, if you want more on this or you want to understand more. I know that a huge amount of work went into this podcast episode. It's just under a half an hour, so it's not a massive undertaking. But the Journal Explainer podcast is excellent on kind of getting to the root of these kinds of things. And the latest episode is about this, and I would recommend it. I listened to it this morning. Okay, now let's move on to the next story. We are... because we've talked about this before, I felt it was worth noting that the Taoiseach has made a statement about the laws on licensing, which refer to bar and nightclub opening hours, which we've discussed multiple times on the podcast. And what has he said, Carl?
Yeah, so it's not happening. Like, that's what I'm taking away from it. You know, it's never going to happen. That's not what he said, but that's what I'm taking from it.
Yeah.
It's unlikely that the laws will be ready for summer. I think, I mean, as you say, we've talked about this before. I can't even remember at this point when these laws were supposed to be brought in. I think it was late 2022.
At one stage it was like, I mean, definitely it was supposed to be done by Christmas. Then we were told to be done by summer. Now, obviously, that's not happening.
I think when it was first introduced, it felt like a matter of urgency and a matter of priority because we were just coming out of lockdown and, you know, hospitality was suffering and people wanted things to do. And it seemed like a very urgent thing that we needed more spaces. Mm. And I think that it's just fallen off the government's agenda. I think they've just prioritized other things. I think Leo Varadkar kind of made a similar point a few weeks ago when he said that, like, Helen McEntee, Justice Minister, who's in charge of this, that she's a busy woman. You know, there's a lot going on in the Department of Justice and that she can't necessarily prioritize this. But that is kind of no comfort to anyone who kind of thinks that this is important. And it is important because, you know, there are club owners, there's a nighttime economy that we need to improve. Mm. Simon Harris, he also said he was asked, you know, when he was last in a nightclub, he said he couldn't remember. So I think it doesn't feel like a priority for this government. And it's not going to be. So I think a thing to kind of bear in mind, right, is that it's not going to be ready for summer, right? Mm. After the summer recess, we are going almost straight into a general election. Like, a general election has to be held, I think, February 8th at the latest. Mm. So, you know, once we're back in August or September, I think it's September, you know, that's what gives you a 5-month period to enact this law. Mm. That's not going to happen. Mm-mm. And then once we have a new government, they can then just shelve it because it's not part of their program for government. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a responsibility to enact it. So that's why I say, you know, semi-jokingly, but maybe truthfully, it's not going to happen. You know, it's like I right now you feel like there's no indication that it's actually going to happen. They've just kicked the can down the road over and over.
I don't understand. One thing that I don't get is the Road Safety Authority has been out saying that this is a bad idea because of road deaths. And like, I'm just not sure that that through line is as clear as they think it is. Like, you know, they say that there have been 63 deaths. Simon Harris said he'd met with the Road Safety Authority this week over the fact that there have been 63 deaths on the road this year, with half of them being under the age of 30. But if people were in nightclubs, they wouldn't be on the road. That's all I'm saying.
That's it. Like, so like, you know, I guess the point is that they're making is that, you know, and I think this has kind of been the argument against it from the beginning, is that people seem to, the argument is like more nightclubs means more alcohol. Or like later opening hours means more alcohol.
Yeah.
And then I guess the sort of, you know, the next logical leap is that like more alcohol means more drink driving.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't know if that really bears, you know, if that stands up to scrutiny. Like, I think because the thing is, you know, if we were to really properly do this the right way, what you would do is, you know, let the nightclubs open until 6 p.m. and also increase nighttime public transport.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a big part of the, you know, reason, like people, like Ireland is a very car crazed country, and it's because our public transport is so poor. Mm. So for me, like, these are all kind of systemic and structural things that all need to be taken into account.
Yeah.
None of it seems like a reason why a nightclub shouldn't be able to open until 6 a.m.
No.
You know, because
by that logic, like, would there not be like, I look, I'm so willing to be wrong. Like, obviously I don't want people to be drunk driving. I don't want young people to die on the roads, obviously. But like, I would like to be pointed to the research in countries where there are looser licensing laws to the direct correlation to, you know, young people dying on the roads. Cause I personally haven't been able to find that.
That's it, because, you know, we obviously, you know, alcohol is a major factor in road deaths.
Yeah.
But is the Road Safety Authority saying that of these 63 road deaths, that some of them were like coming to and from nightclubs or pubs, you know, like that? So the correlation, as you say, is not clear.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, they're the Road Safety Authority. You're not going to dismiss it and what they have to say.
No.
But I just think that maybe, you know, given that Simon Harris is kind of now putting forward like almost this reason not to do something, that it needs to be explained a bit clearer.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it is unfortunate, because ultimately I think this section of society, you know, nightclubs, nightlife in Ireland has been neglected for so long.
Yeah.
It's not a powerful lobby.
No.
And I think, you know, but as I say, this can has been kicked down the road again and again and again.
Yeah.
And soon enough, we're going to have a new government that hasn't promised to do this.
Yeah.
So whether or not it ever happens, I think, you know, remains to be seen.
Yeah. And one thing I would say is, and look, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably the kind of person who votes anyway. But if you are someone who feels strongly about this kind of thing and you're in, you know, your 20s, your 30s, whatever, would you believe, Carl, now there are people in their 20s who listen to this podcast, even though I'm 105? But like, voting and becoming politically active is the only way really that, you know, younger people are going to become a priority of the government, because at the end of the day, the government wants to stay in government. And so they want to please the electorate. And if young people aren't part of the electorate, if they aren't opting into voting and stuff, which I don't think is the case anymore, you know, then these things won't be a priority. So, you know, I think that this should be among the things that we bring up at the doors as they come to us before the next general election, because it does just feel like, oh, sure, affect them. Even though, as you say, there's so many parts to it. It's not just about young people having a social life. It's about lots of other elements as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Speak elections.
Yes. Well, exactly. Okay. I saw this story yesterday and I was truly, my mouth fell open. I turned my phone. I was in the pub. I turned my phone to my friends and we all said, what? And actually with me was Sinead O'Carroll, who's the editor of the Journal.ie. And it was the Journal.ie that I saw it on. And she obviously wasn't at work. She was like, what? We were all just like, yeah. What? So what was the story, Carl?
Same. I saw a tweet from Gav Riley and I was like, is that a joke?
I was like, am I on Waterford Whispers? Like, what is going on?
And what we're talking about is that Kyle Benicio kind of regarded, he's the hero or one of the heroes who stepped in and stopped the Parnell Square stabbing. Mm-hmm. He attacked the assailant with his helmet. The delivery driver from Brazil, famously, like, his GoFundMe made loads of money, and he was regarded as a hero and is regarded as a hero, absolutely. And it was announced yesterday that he's running in the local elections for Fianna Fáil, you know, just kind of out of nowhere. who saw that coming, you know?
I certainly did not. I did not see that coming. It is so unexpected. And I don't know, will I ever get my head around it, to be honest?
This guy, you know, he's a hero, so he's probably going to get elected, realistically. Like, you know, it's a huge coup for Fianna Fáil, a huge get for Fianna Fáil.
Yeah.
I would imagine that if any party could have taken him on board, they would have taken him, you know, because we're talking about kind of a, like, as we say, like a literal hero. Mm. You know, it's not often that you have like a proper, you know, guy who's saved lives. Mm. In a situation like that. So it's just very
something,
you know? Yeah. It's I think what anyone
expected.
You know.
We just didn't expect it. It's just so unexpected. Yeah. There's a photo of him with Micheál Martin as well on Twitter. Micheál Martin said, I am delighted that Caio Benicio, am I saying that right? Benicio?
Yeah, Caio Benicio, yeah.
Caio Benicio will contest the upcoming local elections for Fianna Fáil Party in the Dublin North and inner city local electoral area. Caio wants to play a greater role in his community, and I think he will make a very fine public representative. More power to him, I guess. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, like, you know, fair enough. You know, this is, you know, whatever you might feel about Fianna Fáil, I mean, this guy has a lot of credit in the bank. You know, so
it's just so unexpected.
I just don't think anyone would have seen it coming. Because I think, you know, after such a major life event, you know, you'd think you might kind of get out of public life. You know, you might want to settle down. I think we're all about to learn a lot more about Caio Benicio, I guess. He's going to become, I guess, a bigger public figure in Ireland. And that'll, you know, let's see.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, like, you know, if you were a Brazilian person driving Deliveroo or working for Deliveroo and, you know, he got quite a sizable GoFundMe, I think I would have moved home.
Yeah, well, see, I think he has children here, I think.
And
They're probably quite settled, I suppose. Yeah, like, I see kids obviously in school here, so.
Well, I think it says a lot that he wants to do this. I mean, he's obviously invested in Ireland and in his community. And
so, I think it's quite heartening that, like, in a time where the far right are on the rise, that a mainstream political party like Fianna Fáil, they see it as a virtue to have this man who, you know, is like... you know, he is a migrant to Ireland and, you know, he has contributed, you know, kind of almost more than a lot of people ever will, because a lot of people are never going to, you know, a lot of people simply just never have the opportunity to do something so heroic.
Yeah.
But the fact is, he took that opportunity and he saved lives.
Yeah.
And that's incredible. And I think it's a positive, I think, that that such a man is sort of being held up as a hero.
Yeah.
I think it just goes to show, and it's sort of like what we were saying last week about the, you know, the Pakistani security guard who was killed in Australia, is that, like, it's sort of, you know, immigrants have so much to contribute. Like, Ireland is richer for having them.
Absolutely.
And I think it's good that Fianna Fáil at the local level are kind of acknowledging that. Mm. And I hopefully that kind of, that's something that we, you know, see more of, is, you know, sort of immigrants being celebrated.
Yeah, and we need more diversity in politics anyway, like 100%. Okay, well, Carl, we've talked for quite some time. Thank you so much. It has been lovely to catch up with you on the news this week, even though some of the stories are challenging. I hope you have a lovely rest of the week now and take care of yourself. You can find Carl's column, Cerulean in the Years, on Saturdays on thejournal.ie. You can also find other bits of his writing there. And of course, he is on the social media as well. Where can people find you, Carl?
People can find me at carl.kinsella on Instagram and at TV's Carl Kinsella on Twitter. Although I'm kind of taking a break from Twitter, but I mean, I've never been able to stay away for long. So, you know, you can follow me and I'll tweet in a couple of weeks.
Okay, thanks very much, Carl. There you have it. That's all the news for this week. I will be back with you on Wednesday with your entertainment catch up. Lots to discuss there as well. As I said, more stuff over on the Patreon if you want it. And I really appreciate you being here. I love you very much. Thanks for letting me do this as part of my work. Thank you to Carl and thanks to Acast for having me on the network. I will talk to you on Wednesday. Have a good one in the meantime. And if you can't have a good one, just keep going.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.